As a part-time journalist, I ran into a poltergeist case in Dublin, which was now called the McKellen case, which by any standards is one of the more extraordinary ones that have ever been. And it went on for a very long time. It involved a young Irish couple who were afflicted from the time that they went to live in an apartment after they got married in Dublin, and they literally were, all hell was let loose by an experience that was provoked by a Ouija board, not so much an actual Ouija board, but a similar thing by setting up letters on a table and using a glass moving around it. And they and a friend came and sat down one night and did this, and they were slightly drunk, and the next minute they were intruded upon by a young man who appeared particularly to the woman, and after that point their life was changed forever.
Was it a disaster for them?
Yes, it was mostly disastrous to begin with. The type of things that took place constituted, you know, major problems. For example, it could literally damage the apartment they were in. It could set fire to things. It could take their money from them. It could tear things open. And it was a continuous and terrifying experience. And they, being, you know, obsessed by it, they eventually would, you know, run from wherever they were to another place and continue to do this. It made the newspapers in Dublin, and it was at that point that I was introduced to them through, because I was doing a column for a journal in England, and I was sent the information, and the editors asked me, could you go and look at this? And they said, we don't think this is probably real. It looks too far-fetched. And there was a second case they gave me, which I never actually got to deal with. But this first one, I went along, and I met the couple who were hiding out in one of their parents' homes.
Oh, they must have been petrified people.
They were absolutely stark, raving petrified. But they'd gotten used to the fear, in a sense, by this point. And they'd tried to get help from so many sources that finally, when I approached them, they said, or the mother of the male said to me, that you're not getting to see them if you're going to report on them. We're sick of the media, and they've done nothing for us. And so I had to undertake not to, and I agreed not to, somewhat reluctantly. But as it turned out, the case opened my world so massively that I could never look back. It was one of the most gargantuan shifts that I've ever been through, and to this day stands as the groundwork upon which I base my beliefs in the paranormal.
Did you ever figure out, Peter, who the poltergeist was?
Yes, we did. He was a young Irishman. His name was never revealed. He never seemed to remember his true name, and it's a long story, but he gave himself the name of Mickey, and he wrote letters from the next reality, which came right in front of us. I have 49 of them preserved. And for some reason, I was able to keep them as a fixative agent, if you want to think of me that way, whereas all the other hundreds and hundreds of letters would disappear back into the ether from where they came. I have a number of hours of tape recording talking with the being, because the woman turned into be a deep trance medium, and the voice would materialize, you know, somewhat outside of her body, maybe 4 or 5 feet away. And
a different voice, or was it still her voice?
No, it was not her voice. It was the voice of a very high-pitched voice, but clearly it was mostly a male-oriented voice, and certainly culturally it was totally male.
During the break, is there any way you can get that tape ready and we can hear it over the phone?
No, unfortunately, I'm remote from my office, and it's archived. Okay. I take great care not to have it exposed too much. I haven't done much with it in a long time, and we've had some big shifts in the office, so I couldn't even put my hands on it quickly at this point.
I bet it was frightening for these people.
For them, it was. Actually, for me at the beginning, it was the most extraordinary and explosive form of terror, because I'd never been exposed to anything like this except in books and movies.
What did he write in his letters?
Well, initially what happened was that I had, pretending that I was going to help these folk because of my, at that time I realized, very limited psychic and spiritual knowledge, I decided to operate on the basis of Dr. Carl Wicklund's work, which is a well-known work called 30 Years Among the Dead. And what he had done, using his wife as the medium, he had used small electric charges to drive the offending entity out of the body of the possessed and into the aura of his wife, who was a medium, and then they would talk to this person and then release them back into, you know, a higher sphere of reality, which, you know, seemed to work, and it was very structured, and I thought, well, why don't I try this? So I obtained a Wheatstone bridge from Professor Farmer at the university, and we set up a circuit. And doing this with a fairly strong battery in the circuit and creating relatively mild shocks, the first letter actually appeared in front of me when this happened. It floated right out in front of them. And I wasn't in the circuit, but I was watching it happen, and it was quite amazing. And then the next morning, or the next day, they came to me with another letter that they'd found inside their car, and it was pinned to the dashboard by apparently an invisible pin, because they couldn't see the pin, but when they tugged on the letter, they heard something fall onto the bare metal. They didn't have any foot mats in this car. It was an old car. And they couldn't find any pin. It seemed to be non-visible, but the letter said, "Please read," in block letters, and on the back of it, in a slightly more cursive hand, it wrote, "If you don't stop giving me electric shocks, I'll do away with you, you bastard."
Jeez.
And that was, they didn't know where this had come from and couldn't connect the dots, so they took it to the police, who, of course, were totally baffled because the car was tightly locked. And then they brought it to me, and of course I recognized that this chap was serious. He didn't like being shocked at all, and he was determined to hold on to them, because in a sense they had become his emotional and spiritual home. Their energy was providing a strong link. So this was kind of one of the major events. But there were thousands of events, and it would take us literally all probably a few hours just to describe them. But what I found in this, and I think this goes to the nature of the skeptic more than anything, during the early stages of the experiences, which I haven't described, I found that I was totally skeptical at the same time as being apparently credulous. And the skeptic inside me, the one that what I think is the regulating device inside everybody, the thing that keeps you on a stable track in the world, that skeptic slowly eroded its hold on my awareness. And eventually I caved in and said, no, this is absolutely 100% real. And real in the sense that this was the reality that was around me, inside, outside, was being created and manifested and could be observed by more than myself.